Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am, a PGY1 about to start residency. Welcome to the 37th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. This is kind of a grab bag podcast, but I decided to name it the Preventive Medicine Podcast. I would say that with this podcast, you'll probably get many, many questions right on many exams you take across your third year, or even for step one, and definitely for step two CK, and almost certainly for step three. Because for this podcast, there are three big things I'm going to focus on. I'm going to focus on risk factors across like the different specialties. I am going to focus on the most common causes of death across the different specialties. And then I'm also going to focus on just some other weird high-yield grab-bag pieces of information. I will highly, highly encourage you to listen to this like the night before an exam or something. You'll almost certainly get many questions right from this. So let's begin. And I will sort of mix and match everything. So the most important risk factor, right, for suicide is actually a prior history of committing suicide, right? So if you've previously attempted suicide, that's the biggest risk factor for having a new suicide. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for AFib? What is the biggest risk factor for AFib? Well, I hope you're thinking about mitral stenosis, okay? Mitral stenosis is the biggest risk factor for AFib. Although, a peripherally related question is to ask about like the most common arrhythmia in a patient with hyperthyroidism. The most common arrhythmia in patients with hyperthyroidism is AFib as well. Now, next question. What is the most important risk factor for mitral stenosis? What is the most important risk factor for mitral stenosis? Well, the answer to that is rheumatic fever. Okay, rheumatic fever very commonly torches the mitral valve and it usually causes mitral stenosis. Okay, so most common risk factor for AFib is mitral stenosis, but for mitral stenosis is rheumatic fever. Now, what is the most common risk factor for an abdominal aortic aneurysm? That is smoking, okay? They'll try to trip you up with hypertension. Don't be dinged by that on a test. The biggest risk factor for AAA is smoking. Now, what is the most important modifiable risk factor for coronary artery disease? That's smoking as well. Okay, that's smoking as well. In fact, if they mention a patient with like an MI and they ask for risk factors, the big thing you want to think about is smoking. But if you don't see smoking as an answer choice, then go with unstable angina. Unstable angina is actually one of the most important risk factors for a myocardial infarction. But the biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease, and it's actually modifiable, is smoking. Now, for stroke and aortic dissection, what is the biggest risk factor? That'll be hypertension. Hypertension is the biggest risk factor for stroke and aortic dissection. And if you get an unusual exam question about a patient that has iron deficiency anemia, and they say, oh, this patient has a history of H. pylori infection, and they ask for the biggest risk factor, well, I hope you think about peptic ulcer disease, right? So H. pylori can cause PUD, and that PUD can then trigger an iron deficiency anemia because you're basically bleeding into your GI tract. Now, what is the most important risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma? That is Barrett's esophagus, okay? They will try to trip you up by putting Barrett's esophagus as an answer choice and GERD as an answer choice. Do not pick GERD. Pick Barrett's esophagus. That's the biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma. Now, what's the most common cause of community-acquired pneumonia? That is strep pneumo, okay? What's the most common cause of UTIs overall? That'll be E. coli. Now, what is a commonly tested exam risk factor for osteoporosis? That's a low BMI, right? So they classically test this in the context of a patient with anorexia nervosa or a patient that is postmenopausal but has like a low BMI, like usually it's like 19 or 18. If you see that, that's the biggest predisposing risk factor for osteoporosis in those populations. And another bizarre thing you want to keep in mind, this is just something I'm just going to go ahead and say out loud, but when you control blood glucose in a diabetic, it actually does not decrease the risk of stroke or a myocardial infarction. So controlling blood glucose does not decrease the risk of stroke or a myocardial infarction in a patient with diabetes. Those are macrovascular complications. The macrovascular complications of diabetes are not prevented with control of blood glucose. The only things that controlling blood glucose helps with are microvascular complications, right? So like a nephropathy, a retinopathy, or a neuropathy. Those things, you can decrease those risks by controlling blood glucose. Now, for a triple A, remember, you screen for triple A in men, not women. Okay, you screen only in men, and you basically screen in a man that has ever smoked and is between the ages of 65 to 75. Usually, you do that with a one-time screening ultrasound. If the aneurysm is greater than 5.5 centimeters, you go ahead, you proceed to surgery. If it's less than 5.5 centimeters, you watch. If it grows by more than 0.5 centimeters in a 6-month period, you also proceed to surgery. If it's symptomatic at any point, you also proceed to surgery. And again, remember, the biggest risk factor for a triple A is smoking. But the greatest risk factor that predisposes a triple A to rupture is the diameter of the aneurysm. The diameter of the aneurysm is the greatest predisposing risk factor to rupture of the triple A. Now, what is the most important risk factor for squamous cell carcinoma of the skin? It's a skin cancer, so what should it be? It should be cumulative sun exposure. Okay, now what's the most important risk factor for ovarian cancer? It's actually having a family history of ovarian cancer. Okay, what is the most important risk factor for prostate cancer? That's age. Okay, age is the most important risk factor for prostate cancer and for breast cancer. Okay, basically, the older a person gets, the higher the risk of prostate cancer or breast cancer. Now, what is the most important risk factor for bladder cancer? That will be smoking. Smoking is the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer. The most common cause of death in patients with getting a kidney transplant is cardiovascular disease. What's the most common cause of death in patients with acromegaly? That's heart failure, okay? And what's the most common cause of death in patients with chronic kidney disease? That's cardiovascular disease as well. And actually, if you want to be like a little more specific, the most common cause of death in patients with end-stage kidney disease is like arrhythmias, like sudden cardiac death from an arrhythmia, okay? The second most common cause of death in patients with end-stage kidney disease is infection. Okay, now moving on. What is the most important risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea? That's obesity. Okay. What is the most important modifiable risk factor for knee osteoarthritis? That's obesity as well. What's the most common cause of death in patients with autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease? It's cardiovascular disease. So here's what they will try to do to you on an exam. They will try to trick you by putting subarachnoid hemorrhage as an answer choice. That is not the most common cause of death in ADPKD. It's actually cardiovascular disease. Okay. Now, what's the most common cause of death in patients with lupus? That's ischemic heart disease, right? So like a myocardial infarction. And what's the commonly tested risk factor on many exams for pancreatic cancer? That's smoking. Okay. Now, what's the most common pulmonary malignancy in patients with a history of asbestos exposure? That's a bronchogenic carcinoma. Okay. Not a mesothelioma. It's a bronchogenic carcinoma. And remember, smoking is very high yield to know this. Smoking is not a risk factor for mesothelioma. And don't forget that mesotheliomas, they are calreticulin positive. So calreticulin. They're calreticulin positive, and you can also see sarcoma bodies, which are laminated calcifications on microscopy. And then don't forget, since we're talking about like the lungs, don't forget that silicosis increases a patient's risk for TB. Now, what is the most common cause of acute pancreatitis in the US? That's gallstones, okay? Not alcoholism. They are roughly equal, to be honest, but at least there's a study I read that said that gallstones are the most common cause of acute, not chronic, acute pancreatitis in the US. However, the most important risk factor for chronic pancreatitis in the US is alcoholism. Okay? Because think about it, right? People drink, it's like a habit, right? People drink over time. Now, I'll just mention this, but there's a classically tested risk factor for papillary thyroid cancer. Do you know what it is? Well, I hope you're thinking about like a history of like chest or like neck radiation for a lymphoma. Okay. And for breast cancer, right, you want to know your screening guidelines. As per the USPSTF, you want to screen every 2 years from the age of 50 to 74. For the American Cancer Society, they say screen every year starting at 40. And I've actually seen this American Cancer Society recommendation what's like most correct on most of the exams I've taken in the past. So it's just something to keep in mind, but I would definitely know both if I were you. American Cancer Society, start at 40 every year. USPSTF, which is supposed to be the most correct, every 2 years starting at the age of 50. Now, for cervical cancer screening, right, you want to do a pap smear every 3 years between the ages of 21 to 30, okay? Basically, if a patient is more than 30 years old, you can also do the same thing. You can do a pap every 3 years. But an alternative, only if you're greater than 30, is to do a pap smear plus HPV co-testing every 5 years. It's definitely high yield to know that. And basically, you screen between the ages of 21 to 65. If a patient has a history of HIV, you actually screen a little more frequently. So you don't screen every 3 years. You screen like every like 1 or 2 years. And basically, you can stop screening before the age of 65 if a lady has a hysterectomy. But here's the kicker. You can only stop screening before the age of 65 if the hysterectomy was done for benign reasons. So let's say like a leiomyoma, for example. If the hysterectomy was done for a non-benign cause like endometrial cancer or something like that, you want to keep doing pap smears. And the buzzword you want to recognize on exams is a pap smear of the vaginal cuff. Okay, it's a very common exam question. Now, with regards to chlamydia screening in general, if a patient has like some high yield risk factors, I'll say like the big one they tend to put a lot on exams is like inconsistent use of condoms. And those patients are less than 25. You can go ahead and screen them for chlamydia. And then with regards to screening for hyperlipidemia, in men, you screen men that are over the age of 35. For women, you screen starting at the age of 45. And I believe you do that every 5 years thereafter. Not sure about that last part though, but I'm almost certain you screen every 5 years. But I'll encourage you to look that up. And it is mega, mega, mega high yield to know that you can actually start before the age of 35 in men or before the age of 45 in women if they are like high risk for coronary artery disease. So you may see exam questions where this patient is 22 and the answer is to screen for lipids. Don't be surprised by that. If they have a lot of risk factors for coronary artery disease, you go ahead and screen them earlier than 35. Now for colon cancer screening is super high yield. In general, you want to screen with colonoscopy. That's the preferred method, every 10 years between the ages of 50 to 75. Alternatively, you can do like a flexig, right? So a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years. Alternatively, you can also do an annual fecal occult blood test. I imagine in the future that CT colonography, it's not yet approved, but CT colonography may become a thing in a few years because it has a very high sensitivity. And basically, like I said, colonoscopy is preferred, but if you say, okay, let me go the FOBT route or the flexible sigmoidoscopy route, if any of those tests are positive, the next step in management is to do a colonoscopy. And for patients with ulcerative colitis, you definitely want to know that colon cancer screening actually starts at 8 years after the initial diagnosis of UC has been made. 8 years after the initial diagnosis. If a patient has like a family history of colon cancer, they also classically test this. You want to start screening at the age of 40, or you want to start screening 10 years before the age where the family member with colon cancer was diagnosed, right? So say, for example, the family member was diagnosed at the age of 49. If you backtrack 10 years, that's 39, right? If you compare 39 and 40, 39 is earlier, so you start screening at 39. But if the patient's family member had cancer at like 52, and you're like, oh, when do I start screening? You start screening at the age of 40, okay? Because if you backtrack 10 years from 52, that's 42 years. But if you compare 40 and 42, 40 is an earlier age. So you start screening at the age of 40. Now, if a patient has a history of familial adenomatous polyposis, you actually want to start annual colonoscopies or like sigmoidoscopies every year, starting between the age of like 10 to 15 years, okay? So once the child hits like anywhere from 10 to 15, start an annual colonoscopy or like a sigmoidoscopy. Basically, the recommendations are roughly the same for HNPCC, but I think that's a little low yield, so I'm not going to say too much about that. But basically, it's like, oh, the youngest age that the family member had colon cancer, start screening like 5 to 10 years before that. In general, I'll say the big thing you should probably remember is for HNPCC, start screening for colon cancer before the age of 21. Now, for all pregnant women, right, at the first prenatal visit, you want to definitely screen for syphilis, right? And you also want to screen for asymptomatic bacteriuria and HIV. And if you detect bacteria in an asymptomatic pregnant woman in her urine, you go ahead and treat. But that recommendation does not extend to a non-pregnant female. Non-pregnant females with asymptomatic bacteriuria are not treated. And if a pregnant woman has asymptomatic bacteria, right, after you treat, usually you treat with like nitrofurantoin, for example, you go ahead and perform a test of cure. But if a pregnant woman has pyelonephritis, after treatment, she actually has to be on chronic prophylaxis against the UTIs for the rest of the pregnancy. And then for RhD immune globulin, right, you want to give that around 28 weeks. And you also probably want to give that within 72 hours of delivery. If you want to determine how like the dose of Rh immune globulin that you want to give to mom, you try to perform this quantitative test where you determine how much of the fetus's blood has mixed with mom's blood. It's a test known as the Kleihauer-Betke test. That's a test you can use to quantitatively determine, okay, this is how much Rogam I should give to mom postpartum. And then a melanoma. What's the most important prognostic factor that indicates the likelihood of spread? Well, I hope you're seeing the depth of the lesion. The depth of the lesion, the breast load depth, is the biggest prognostic factor that indicates how likely the melanoma will spread. Now, what is the most important preventive measure in hepatocellular carcinoma? That's actually Hep B vaccination. Okay, remember, Hep B can cause HCC and it's a vaccine preventable illness. So the most important preventive measure in HCC is Hep B vaccination. And remember, if you vaccinate against Hep B, you've basically prevented Hep D. Now, what is the most important risk factor for erectile dysfunction? That's cardiovascular disease. Okay. What is the most common cause of death in patients with cervical cancer? That's actually renal failure from genitourinary spread. Classically, it's the ureters that the cancer spreads to. And just as a general rule, in general, the most important prognostic factor in patients with like cancer is like the stage of the tumor. And for lung cancer, right, there's actually screening for lung cancer. The USPSTF recommends like a low-dose CT scan for men and women between the ages of like 55 to 80 if they have a greater than 30-pack-year smoking history. And you need to remember some addendums, though. These people, they either have to still be smoking or quit within the past 15 years. If the patient has quit more than 15 years ago, this recommendation does not apply to them anymore, okay? So lung cancer, low-dose CT scan, men and women, 55 to 80, who have a greater than 30-pack-year smoking history and currently smoke or have quit within the last 15 years. So if it's 15 years or less since they last quit, you go ahead and do the screening. And again, greater than 30-pack-year smoking history. Now, what's the most important risk factor for endometritis? That's a C-section, okay. What's the most important risk factor for preeclampsia? It's actually a prior history of preeclampsia. What's the highest, what's like a high yield exam risk factor for uterine inversion? It's actually a prior history of inversion. Now, what's the high yield exam risk factor for chorioamnionitis? You love this one. It's actually a history of prolonged rupture of membranes. And this I'll just say out loud, having a biconduit uterus actually increases risk for preterm delivery. What is the biggest risk factor for placenta previa? It's a history of C-section. And this is something I guess I'll say out loud. Bacterial vaginosis, right? Remember, Gardnerella vaginalis, vaginal pH greater than 4.5, Klue cells on microscopy. Bacterial vaginosis, which you treat with metronidazole, is actually a high yield risk factor for preterm labor. That's a very common exam question. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for endometrial cancer? That's actually exposure to unopposed estrogen. Exposure to unopposed estrogen is the biggest risk factor for endometrial cancer. If you don't see exposure to unopposed estrogen as an answer choice, go with endometrial hyperplasia. Go with endometrial hyperplasia. But the biggest risk factor is exposure to unopposed estrogen. So a lady with like PCOS or a lady taking like tamoxifen, they have a high risk of endometrial cancer. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for cervical cancer? That'll be exposure to HPV. Especially the high risk types like HPV 16, 18, and those in the 30s. And actually, they may give you a peripheral answer instead of giving like, exposure to HPV. They could give you an answer choice that is something where if you participated in that behavior, you have an increased risk of exposure to HPV. For example, they could say like a person that has like multiple sexual partners or like an early age of sexual intercourse, those things increase risk of HPV acquisition, right? So that actually increases a patient's risk of cervical cancer. And remember, HPV causes squamous cell cancer of the cervix, not adenocarcinoma, squamous cell cancer. And just one bizarre thing that I came across recently that you, I guess you want to keep in mind is, the reason why young females have an increased risk of like vaginal infections, especially like cervical infections, is because they have more cervical ectopy. So the cervix has two parts, right? There's an endocervix that's made of like columnar epithelium, and there's an ectocervix that's made of squamous epithelium. The thing is, that squamous epithelium is sort of like hardcore. It's more resistant to infection in comparison with the endocervix. But the thing is, the endocervix tends to bulge out more in younger females, and that columnar epithelium is not very good at guarding against infection. So infection is vaginal infections are pretty common in young females because they have more cervical ectopy. So their cervical epithelium has increased susceptibility to infection. Just one of those bizarre things you want to keep in mind. But as you get older, the endocervix sort of like stays where it's supposed to be, so you don't get many of those problems. Now, one of the strongest exam risk factors I would say for ectopic pregnancy is a prior history actually of ectopic pregnancy. But the other things you want to keep in mind, like smoking, because smoking messes with the motility of like this, I believe they're like cilia or stereocilia that line the fallopian tubes. One high yield risk factor I will say in terms of exams for cervical incompetence is actually a history of like a LEEP procedure, like the LEEP procedure, or like a cervical conization procedure. So those are things to keep in mind. A high yield risk factor for shoulder dystocia, what do you think that would be? That's macrosomia. And what is the high yield exam risk factor for fetal macrosomia? That'll be a pre-existing or like gestational diabetes in the mom. And for your exam, you want to remember certain high yield risk factors for developing pyelonephritis in pregnancy. For that, you want to think about like asymptomatic bacteriuria, and prior pyelonephritis. Now, some just other weird things I'll mention. You definitely want to avoid combined OCPs, right? Another buzzword you may see is like triphasic contraception. Triphasic contraceptives contain estrogen. You want to avoid combined OCPs in smokers or patients that have like history of strokes or patients that have a history of like migraines with like neurological symptoms. So like super complex migraines. If a patient has a history of like thrombogenic disease, you like factor five lighting, for example, you want to avoid an estrogen containing a contraceptive option. Another high yield one that they love to test is a history of hepatic adenomas. That's definitely a contraindication to the administration of an estrogen containing contraceptive. And a super bizarre question a person may get on an exam that may just throw many people off is avoiding the copper IUD in a patient that has a history of Wilson's disease. Okay, kind of makes sense, right? Because Wilson's disease is a copper overload disorder. Now, for urinary incontinence, I will say that age is probably a good high yield and important risk factor you want to keep in mind. Although also like having like multiple vaginal deliveries, that's also like a big risk factor, especially like stress incontinence. MS, multiple sclerosis, classically on exams, is associated with like urge incontinence. And then diabetes, classically on exams, is associated with overflow incontinence. And in general, the most significant risk factor for placental abruption is what? That's trauma, okay? If you don't see this, go with cocaine on your exams. And for preeclampsia, like I said, the biggest risk factor is a prior history of preeclampsia. Although nulliparity, if you don't see like a prior history of preeclampsia as an answer choice, probably go ahead and choose nulliparity. That's a very high yield important risk factor for preeclampsia. And then, like I mentioned earlier, the biggest risk factor for breast cancer is age. That's also the biggest risk factor for prostate cancer, okay, age. And the final thing I'll mention here is a relatively high yield risk factor for Asherman syndrome, right? So that's like intrauterine adhesions. That's more OB-GYN territory. It's actually having a history of like a uterine curettage. Okay, so that's something you want to keep in mind. So I know this is kind of a lot, but I promise you, this is super, super high yield for exams. So spend the time, go over it, take notes, make flashcards, whatever you do to keep it straight in your mind. And I wish you all the best on your tests. The World Cup started today. Obviously, I'm supporting Nigeria, but I feel like this World Cup will be filled with a lot of shocking upsets, but I'll go off my soapbox for now. I'll keep you updated on how things are going for my favorite teams for the World Cup. So have a wonderful day, all the best on your exams, and God bless. Thank you.